Welcome to the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast, where we go inside what makes a coach a coach.
Some people say they do a lot of the same, but others say, no, coach, your practice is different than everybody else. I don't know, and I really don't care. I'm just trying to develop our kids the best we can.
The Guardians of the Game podcast is a production of the National Association of Basketball Coaches and IMG, and is brought to you by Wilson Sporting Goods. And now your host, Coach Dave Odom.
Welcome back to another edition of the NABC Guardians of the Game podcast. Today's guest is one of the very best in the profession, and I claim him to be one of my best friends in the profession, somebody that I really, really admire what he's doing and the way he's doing it. That's the head coach of the Michigan Wolverines, Coach John Beilein. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Dave, very much. That's quite an honor to be considered one of your friends. That's a great thing. That's a great honor.
Well, you know, I always tell my wife it's easy to tell the truth, buddy, and you are.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's talk about how you got involved in this crazy game of basketball. You grew up in upstate New York, and when I say upstate New York, I really mean upstate. Yeah. Tell me, let's see, you grew up in Lockport, New York. I don't know how close that was to the Canadian border, but it had to be right on top of it.
Yeah, what happened was I'm the eighth of nine children, Dave. And when I was born, there wasn't any more room at the house in the city of a place called North Tonawanda. And I was like the last of the baby boomers. So my dad just went out and went and bought this 5-acre old farmhouse right on the shores of Lake Ontario, about 40 miles north of Buffalo, almost between Niagara Falls and Rochester. And I grew up there with my eight brothers and sisters, and my dad worked in the paper mill, but he also had a fruit farm and just a couple hundred trees. And that's where I grew up. And what this backstory of being a coach is that my mother, his last name is Niland, N-I-L-A-N-D. This is the famous Niland family that the Saving Private Ryan is based on.
Wow.
Three of her cousins were reported all missing at the same time. And but the Niland family is sort of like the first family of coaching in the Buffalo area. My uncle was the coach at Canisius for a while. My other uncle, who was a hero in World War II, was at Bastogne, was a 101st, and he founded the Lemoyne College program, coached there for 20 or 30 years. My uncle Mike was a historic high school coach, and I grew up. My dad worked in the paper mill, was a blue collar guy. He used to take me to their games, and I was always I was so envious of their children. We all had these big families. Their dad had the keys to the gym. My dad had the keys to the loading dock at the paper mill. And so I was so envious of them and just that one thing. And I said, you know what? I'd love to be a coach. I'd love to have the keys to the gym.
The Beilein family's probably still getting royalties from Saving Private Ryan.
No, I mean, it's an incredible story that I really grew up with. But you can imagine, that's my mother's first three cousins. And of course, they all went. There was four boys in that Niland family, and two that were of draft age in my mother's family. And they all went together, all six of them, right after Pearl Harbor. They were going, and but three of them being reported missing in the same week, and then two did die on D-Day, but the other one was actually came home many years later. And it's a great story in my life, and we're very proud of it.
In getting ready for this 30 minutes, I looked hard, long and hard. I can't find anything about your playing career in high school. Come on now, tell me. You had to be a good player.
I was okay, Dave. I was just okay. I went to a public school in that area in Newfane, New York. That's where I went to high school. And in the 10th grade, they stopped sports. There was this budget crisis. They stopped sports. And I transferred to the Catholic school that was 20 miles, 15 miles away, 10 miles away. And that's where I played. I was a starter all 4 years, but extremely, you know, 10 points, 5 assists type of guy, nothing great, virtually unrecruited. I just made up my mind. I was going to go to a small school I was going to make the team as a walk-on. I went to Wheeling Jesuit. I didn't even visit, Dave. I just went and went to the, you know, went the first day to school. I got accepted. I got two loans to pay for it. I got $500 from working all summer in a bean factory where you make frozen beans. And I went and paid for it myself. And pretty soon, within a year, I was on the team, given a scholarship the next year, the captain later on in my career, and the rest is history. People don't do that. People don't go to college without visiting a college anymore. I was one of them.
Wow. You have served at long and hard at a lot of places. I know your wife, Kathleen. Listen, I mean, let's see, one, two, I think there's eight different moves you've made in coaching here. I mean, like every spring, does she like try to stay away from you because she's afraid you're going to come in and say, Kathleen, what would you think about moving to, and then you name a place? I mean, is it like, it's got to be a kind of nervous time around there for the B-lines.
Yeah, there were times, and there were a few almost moves too.
Uh-oh.
And she's actually been with me through it all, just to say, okay, you decide what's best. I think there was some that she was more in favor of than others, but at the same time, I mean, one thing she's a five star at is getting the house ready for sale, and making money off of it, because it seems like every time we move but one, you know, we got more than we paid for it, and for a long time that was the only savings that we could ever have was equity in a house, but she's tremendous at it, and she was ready all the time. We got rid of a lot of junk a lot of times when we made those moves.
Quickly, let's go through each of those eight moves. What did you learn at Newfane High School? That was your first job. Well,
yeah, I walked in, Dave. It's a great story because I was actually that was during the time where the schools were declining in enrollment. Because, like I said, I was one of the last of the baby boomers, and they were declining, and so there was no jobs open. And I came out of Wheeling Jesuit with a degree in social studies, history with a social studies certification to teach, and there was nothing. So I was actually digging dishes. I was putting in sewer line in an area where everybody had their own sewers. They didn't have like a city sewage. So I was actually down in a hole.
Wow.
with actual human increment coming into the hole, because you'd patch it up and you'd go along. And my dad was at the top of the hole. He said, there's a job open at Newfane High School. Right. And I ended up getting it and ended up being coaching football, basketball, baseball. And 2 years as the JV head coach, and then 1 year as the varsity head coach. And two seasons ago, we had a JV team from 1977. 13 of the 14 guys on that team showed up, came to a Michigan game. We went out and had a few drinks afterwards and dinner, and I never laughed so hard in my life. I said, I really did that at 22. it was wonderful. I was 22, and they were 18. They were 17. It was incredible growth period for me, that's for sure.
I love it. Erie Community College.
My dad thought I was crazy, that I had this job paying $7,000 a year, $8,000 a year at Newfane, and that why would you give, you're going to get tenure next year, why would you give up all this to go and be a junior college coach? And I did it anyhow. For 4 years there, my job was always in jeopardy because was there going to be funding to hire a full-time coach? And sure enough, after 4 years there, we had some success. I got to know a few people around the area, and it was frustrating in junior college. Just when you got the kids to play the way you wanted them to play, they were gone. They were going to a four-year school. You had the opportunity to go to Nazareth College in Rochester, New York. It was a small private school, which I was accustomed to, like Wheeling, where I went. And as a result, I was offered the job and took it. And that's how this whole thing started.
Lemoyne College, where your son Patrick is now the head coach.
So I went to Nazareth for a year. We were 20-6. We had a great year, but we were settled in there. We weren't doing anything. There was a few people, places that could take me away. But as I said, I used to go to the Lemoyne basketball games. I worked at their camps. I was very close with the family of the athletic director there, who was also my uncle. My cousins had gone there, and I just knew a lot about Lemoyne. So when the opportunity came up, I didn't apply for it because I worried about, you know, it being a relative and all those things. They wouldn't hire me, or it would not be right. And my uncle actually called me on the last day and said, "Why haven't you applied? Right? You'd be somebody interested." I didn't think, you know, he said, "I would not hire you because you're my nephew. I would hire you if you're the best man. So get your resume in and get it here. And if the committee thinks you're good enough, we'll have you in for an interview." And that started that. I mean, it was those days, Dave, where I had to go then in one day, go find a typist who could update my resume because I couldn't type. And, you know, they had to do it perfect. It had to be perfect, but there was no computers or correction. They had to do it perfect.
Wow.
And I got it, and I sent it airmail. There was no FedEx. I had to get it airmail to them, which I don't know how it got from Rochester to Syracuse. I could have got there by car probably faster, and ended up going there and interviewing. And when it was all said and done, no one on the committee knew that I was. This is the way the story was told me. No one on the committee knew that I was my uncle's nephew.
Wow!
And they voted unanimously for me. And that's I was nine. We had nine great years there, where three of our children were Patrick. Patrick was actually born the 2 days before the Lemoyne interview, and Mark and Andrew were both born there as well. And that was nine great years of coaching Division II, where everybody's in a hurry to get to Division I. I made so many mistakes and learned so much that I wouldn't have survived at Division I if I didn't have that period of grace and that period of patience by our athletic department. As I grew as a coach, and we won a lot of games, but I wouldn't have survived in Division I. I wasn't ready yet.
You think when he went through the interview process that anybody knew that Patrick was your son?
Yeah, they all knew. Yeah. they all knew that when Patrick came back, and they was blessed to have that one. And by that time, the whole Nyland family had was no longer involved with Lemoyne in that degree, but. I was really we when he had that opportunity to go there. We were so pleased for him, and I'll be. I listened to all his games. Dave, I know Lynn appreciates this too. I mean, now it's like over 1,200 games I've coached, and Kathleen's probably been a part of most every one. Either she was listening to the game, watching it on TV, and she goes through that when I'm watching one of Patrick's games, and I'm sure you're like this with your son too. I'm like. It's awful. I mean, I am nervous. Oof. I'm mad. I don't
worst.
Like the officials. And when I was coaching, I don't feel anything. I'm just working. So it's really been fun. At the same time, I have appreciation for what Kathleen and Lynn have gone through for years and years and years. Because it's not easy when you're not in control of your team.
All right, you stepped up a notch. You went into Buffalo. Canisius, where you and I first kind of met, yep. And we began playing games. What was the experience like at Canisius?
Well, that was another crazy story that I'll save for a book sometime, but somehow I got that job. There was a lot of people applying, and I got the job. That was very, very, took a lot of courage for Father Dembski, who was the president there, Dan Starr, the AD, Tom Miller, who was the dean of students, to hire a Division II guy with no Division I experience. I mean, you don't see that very much. You know, John Thompson had done it at Georgetown, but he had played at Providence. Paul Evans had done it at Navy, right? And
right.
That was just about it. There wasn't many other ones that never had experience. And so they gave me a shot. And we ended up really – I fell into a good class coming in. Marty Marbach, the ex-Villanova assistant, had been the the head coach there, and unfortunately got let go. But he didn't leave the cupboard bare. Michael Meeks was waiting there for me, and a kid named Binky Johnson and Craig Wise. They were all Hall of Fame. All the are Hall of Famers at Canisius, and they were like freshmen and sophomores waiting for me. And then we brought in a kid named Daryl Barley, who in his first game scored 24 against Duke, and he came in, and all of a sudden we were able to really have some success there, and it was a great 5 years, just an incredible time of our life. And it was back home now. Syracuse is 2 hours from Buffalo. My family, the Nyland families, all these people, it was big for my family to come back home. Kathleen's family was there, which is really important for her to come back near her mom and her dad. And it was a great 5 years at Canisius.
Before we leave the city of Buffalo, a while back on one of these very podcasts, we did a 30-minute session with Nate Oates. I know you know what it's like to coach in Buffalo, and there's a lot of great things about it, but there's some difficulties too. It's not for everybody. Yeah. Nate Oates is doing one heck of a job right now. Would you not agree?
No, it's fantastic, and it just shows you, because I see him as a little bit of who I was. I was a high school coach, junior college coach. I didn't go up the normal ranks of being a college assistant, and he at Romulus High School, which is 30 minutes from the Ann Arbor campus, he had tremendous teams every year. And then Coach Hurley took a chance at him in Buffalo to come in and recruit for him. And out of nowhere. And he came in, and then the AD, I'm forgetting his name right now, went and hired him when Coach Hurley went to Arizona State. That took some courage as well. And they're the real deal, Dave. They're the real deal. I like to go to Buffalo. I don't want to ever go there and play them. That's for sure.
Mm. You know, I remember, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks back, they went into Syracuse and beat them. I mean, that was an incredible thing. I mean,
Great. They went into Morgantown and won two, and then they going to Syracuse and winning at the Dome. I don't know about you, but I don't have a W there. That's for sure. And I've been there a lot. It's a tough place to play, and Coach Boeheim is one of the best. So no, that was a huge win. And you know, Buffalo's got a tremendous academic potential. But you know, it was just Division III. It was Division III when I was at Lemoyne, slowly going to Division II. But it's this huge campus, a great academic school, but New York State does not have. Like you have North Carolina, you have Virginia, you have, you know, Penn State. You don't have a New York State school.
Right.
And Buffalo is one of the few Division I programs. At one time, they were all Division III. Now Binghamton, Albany, Buffalo are all in Division I. But there's no school like that. And Buffalo is sort of becoming that school for that state, at least upstate.
All right, let's quickly go through these others. Richmond. First experience really out of the state of New York. You're down in the South. You got to learn to eat barbecue and slaw and hush puppies and still coach at the same time. Got to have been tough.
You know, another unique experience going down there because Kathleen's mother had just passed away like a month before suddenly, and it was a difficult time. And all of a sudden, Chuck Boone, the AD, calls us. And says, we'd like you to be the next coach of Richmond. We'd like you to come down here. And, of course, I leave Buffalo, and it's about 30 degrees, icy and snow, and I go down to Richmond. We both go down to Richmond, and the azaleas are out. It's like 70 degrees. It's the middle of March, and I was just blown away. I said, this is where I wanted to coach. However, it was just the wrong time to leave. Because of the passage of Kathleen's mom and the whole thing. So we told them no. We said no. And long story short, Chuck Boone says, I'm not going to take no for an answer. Let's meet in Indianapolis in a week, and I will let's talk again. And you got the job until we come to Indianapolis. If you don't want it by then I'll go elsewhere. And so, sure enough, I go to Indianapolis, and he's waiting for me, and I decided this is where we want to go. Kathleen said, let's do it, and we never looked back.
in 2002. You take the job at West Virginia. Another real change for you. I mean, it. I mean, you're going. You talked about azaleas and dogwoods and all those. There's beauty up in them mountains in West Virginia, but different kind. West Virginia was your next stop.
Yep, and that's we're 5 years. We're 5 years everywhere, and we ended up having this opportunity, and that was, you know, Bob Huggins, I thought was going to get the job and turn it down, and then Dan Dockage took the job for a couple of weeks, and then he left, and we were hired there, and we were very, very fortunate. We brought in a class of two or three of them I've never seen before. It was late. It was like April 18th, and with Kevin Pisnoglu, and I told my son he couldn't play for me at Richmond till his junior year, and then at least because we had a really good team, and he ended up now I go to West Virginia. I said, I need you, Patrick. I need you. He said, wait a minute, I couldn't play at Richmond, but now I can play at West Virginia. And I said, I just need you. And that, Mike Ganzi and Dior Fisher, Pitch Noggle, Joe Airbear, J.D. Collins, boy, they came in, and that group within 3 years was in the Elite Eight. And that was, the people in West Virginia were absolutely fantastic. It was just a tremendous experience. I got two graduates from West Virginia, and it's just a tremendous place to coach at. And there's few places that I would ever have left West Virginia for. Michigan was one of them.
That brings us to the Blue and Maize. It is. I mean, 2007, you get the offer. You're still there today in looking at what's happened in those years. Your all-time record is 734, 418. Junior college, of course, 75 and 43. But what you've done at Michigan, I mean, and still doing at Michigan, I mean, people just remain amazed at. You've been to two Final Fours, one in 13 and one in 18. You've won two Big Ten championships, one in 17, one in 18, an NIT championship in 07, which I think was amazing in your first year there, and you've been Coach of the Year in the Big Ten. All right, so there is no school with more tradition than Michigan. You're in the Big Ten. You're fighting off these giants. I mean, the Wisconsins and the Michigan States and the Purdues and the Indianas. You go on and on and on and on. What's it like coaching in the Big Ten today, John Beilein?
Well, I think when I went into it, there was 11, and it was different. There were 18 leagues. There was 18 games. There were a lot of programs rebuilding. I think a couple of years before that, they might only got three teams in the Big Ten. But at the same time, during that first year there, Jim Delaney, our commissioner, began the Big Ten Network, and it just exploded. And so did our conference over time. You know, Nebraska was added, right? So that was, and then Maryland and Rutgers was added, and now you're competing with 14 teams. A difference of styles, Dave, is unbelievable with 14 teams. I mean, you can remember in the ACC, maybe you had eight teams, and it was, you know, you had those eight styles. Now you got 14 different styles to get ready for, 13 other styles. So it is, and we got a who's who of coaches in this league. So it's really been, it's been difficult, but incredible support. Tommy Amaker was the coach there before me. If Tommy had the facilities we have right now, it might never lost a game. I mean, it is like incredible what they've done for us, because Michigan had really 11 years without an NCAA tournament. They were just we just had Chrysler. It was just, you know, share with the women, no practice facility. It just needed an overhaul. And sure enough, our ADs, I've had two presidents and four ADs, and every one of them has been so positive with men's basketball. They've made us better along the way, and now we're virtually having sellouts every game, and really playing at a national level again.
John, you're known, and I know you would never say this, but I'll say it for you. You're known for your coaching, but you're also known for doing things the right way. You care about ethics. The NABC is the board has been good to you and you to them. Tell us a little bit about your value of doing things the right way and the importance of being ethical in the way not only that you live, but in the way you coach, and how you direct your assistant coaches in that same direction.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said, we go back, and I grew up in a household where that was so important. You know, when your parents went through the Depression like your parents did and my parents did, there's certain values that are so much bigger than money. And so that was embedded in me as a youngster all the way, to tell the truth, do the next right thing, I mean, over and over again. But I think where it really cemented with me was when I was at Lemoyne. And again, my uncle Tom Nyland, or like I said, a hero at Bastogne, 101st, incredible man, who was the chairman of the, as a Division II AD, chairman of the NCAA Infractions Committee. When SMU got the death penalty, Dave, he was the chairman of the Infractions Committee. Mm. And he always used to just, John, follow the spirit of the rule. Don't find ways around the rule. What is the spirit? And you will never get yourself in trouble. The rules are changing all the time. What's the spirit of the rule? And if you follow those things, and that's where we've gone. And I say, you know, when people are, well, I got to bump this guy, or you're trying to do things that others are doing. No, in evaluation period, it's evaluation period. We're not supposed to bump people. We're not supposed to have communication with them. It's an evaluation. So you need to walk right out of the gym when it's over. And you know what? We get the right kids, Dave, because the families that appreciate the way our assistant coaches and we operate want that type of coach. And if they want the other coach who bends the rules a little bit, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But we want kids who get this part, that it's not, there's so many more important things than, you know, out recruiting somebody because you were slicker. You know, we want that kid that comes for the intrinsic values, that wants Michigan, and it's worked out really well for us.
Back in 2017, if my memory holds me right, we started out the year together over in Maui, and your team was basically new to you at that time. You had a really good Maui experience. I think you won two and lost one. Is that right or not? Two and
yeah.
one?
Yeah, we yeah. did. We lost LSU.
And I remember walking out of the gym over there with you that day, and you were shaking your head, and you said, Dave, I just don't think we're going to be very good. And I remember saying to you,
you did.
they haven't had a good dose of John Beilein coaching yet. I remember that conversation now. I remember it very well. Well,
I thought you were crazy.
No. It was early in the year, and I could see maybe sometimes you can be, you know, too close to the forest to see the trees. That's where you were. I was removed from it a little bit, and I could see, and I know what you could do. So anyway, what the product that you loaded the bus and got on the plane and left Maui with that year, 2017, was not the same team that played in the Big Ten tournament and conference championships and all of those later in the year. The point I'm trying to make is this. You have been what I would call a developmental kind of coach. Your team start one place, they gradually get better each and every week, each and every month. They build to the point where they are very, very good at conference tournament time and then in the postseason play in NCAA. Now, my question to you is, where did you learn all of the fundamentals that you teach, and do you still value that above this run and jump and block shots and dunk and behind the back, and they don't know how to pivot, they don't know how to catch it, they don't know how to pass? Talk to me.
Well, I think it comes from the blessing that I've had is coming up along these ranks where we weren't, I didn't walk in as an assistant where everybody was a 4-star, 5-star recruit, and they could pivot, and they could pass, and they could shoot. That when you're at division, junior high school, junior college, Division III coach, there's things you got to teach, and there's things you have to run to win games that maybe are so fundamentally solid. You win games, you don't lose them. You don't beat yourself. So when you get this mentality, how can you play so you don't beat yourself and you can beat others? You say, now the more athletic we get, the better we get. We're not losing those fundamentals. And because this will really work if we're teaching a guy like Tim Hardaway Jr., right, some of these basics. He's got the talent level to play at a different level, but he still has to have these basics in too, whether it's footwork, all these things. And that's been a key. I mean, if you went to see our practice the day in San Antonio the day before, you would have seen the same drills that we were done the first day. And it was pivoting, it was passing, and it's catching the ball with two hands. It's shooting the ball with the right rotation on it, all being emphasized every single day. And that's I don't know any other way to do it. You know, I've never been assistant coach, so I don't know what other people do, Dave. So when you guys come to practice, I just say, okay, well, what do you think? What do other people do? And some people say they do a lot of the same, but others say, no, coach, your practice is different than everybody else. I don't know, and I really don't care. I'm just trying to develop our kids the best we can.
Okay, we're getting close to the end here, and I want to give you a lot of leeway on this, and you take it in any direction you want. If you were the person in charge of college basketball, what is the first rule that you would change? And I'm not necessarily talking about on the court rules, but it could be that. It could be the state of college basketball. It could be one and done. It could be just take that any direction you want to go as we wrap this 30 minutes up.
If I could just take a wand, a miracle wand, and put it over the game, I would say we have to have this mentality. Our student, I have no issues with young men going pro, going early, right? If they can do that, that's tremendous, and we're at full support. If we could put a wand on it, everybody coming in, do not look to the pros until somebody says to you, you're going to get drafted. Just get kids, put their nose to the grindstone, and just keep working. And what's happening is you see transfers or you see kids not playing well because they're in such a hurry, right, to be a 25-year-old when they're 18 and 19. And it's that whole idea, and you saw it with Tim Duncan, you know, how he grew over 4 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, what is he in the league for 20? Because he embraced the college experience. And I'm not saying people shouldn't go after 1 or 2 years if they're ready. But when they are possessed with, I got to get out of here. Wait a minute. It's like you're in the best social environment of your life. You know, you'll never have anything like this where you're living with other kids all your age. It's tremendous. You're being coached up. You're flying charter. You got great gear. You got sellout crowds. And yet we're in a hurry to get out of that. That's the biggest thing that we got to continue to work at to make sure that our kids appreciate and really value what's going on in their lives from the age of 18 to 22.
Last thing, you had a health scare last summer. Mm-hmm. What did that cause you to, you know, you back up a step and you say, uh-oh, yeah. What do I need to do? I know your wife is important, yeah, and looking, yeah, after you, and you got the beautiful, yeah, lake house, and you rested, and, you know, what does that mean to you?
Well, I think that, you know, I got a lot of great DNA from my family, and one of the ones that wasn't so great was I inherited something from my father, which is a propensity to build a plaque in my arteries. And so it took me 65 years to build up enough so they say, wait a minute, we got to do open heart surgery on you. Sort of came out of surprise because I was in good shape and exercising and doing everything. So I think that the big thing that I realize right now that this life can change very quickly in a second, and that you have to embrace even more of what's going on. I mean, we had a near plane crash a year before that, and it's sort of God's trying to wake me up right now and saying, hey, listen. That out-of-bounds play ain't not as important as hugging your wife, of valuing seeing your grandkids, of growing these kids you're blessed to coach every single day. And that's what I'm trying to focus on as much as I can after years and years of being way too focused on winning the next game. So I think that's a healthy thing, and I try to, show a great deal of gratitude every day in every way I can.
Well said. I want to take just a second to say to everyone, I hope you appreciate the last 30 minutes. The insights that Coach Beilein has given and shared with everyone is truly remarkable. I mean, he's had a remarkable career. I mean, one of the things that we didn't highlight that he said, never been assistant coach. That's an amazing. There are not many like that that have coached that many years. And so, you know, from the NABC, John, I want to say thank you. You're a great guardian of the game, and you've taken time to contribute to our weekly podcast. And also to John, I want to just say, you're a great coach. Everybody knows that, but you're an even better friend. You've been a great role model to all the young coaches. You've got a great wife. You got a great family. You got great grandchildren. You've had a great life, and you just—I just want you to keep coaching forever and ever and ever, because I enjoy seeing your teams as they get better throughout the year. So good luck the rest of the year this year, and let's stay in touch.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure.